Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
Toy department time, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. And as I just learned, closet Frank Zappa fan over there, Matt Kolsky.
Not closeted at all. I'm an open Frank Zappa fan.
Are you? I mean, I've known you for years, and this is brand new information to me.
Well, I'm not a diehard, you know. It's not like Frank Zappa's not in my top five bands or anything, but I enjoy Frank Zappa, the irreverence and the tremendous guitar playing both appeal to me.
In the pre-show meeting, he sang a Frank Zappa song and then was stunned when I had not heard said Frank Zappa song, which was what was the Frank Zappa song?
Baby Snakes.
Yeah,
Snakes. It's a great
song.
Please
send us an email if you're familiar with this jam.
People know Baby Snakes. Even as a joke, I think. Maybe not. Maybe I'm totally off base here.
There's no fish heads if we're just doing jokey animal songs.
Fair enough. There's some other, I can think of some other jokey animal songs.
you can?
Yeah, what about, what's the name of the song? Is it the song 3 Feet High and Rising? Hi, I'm Mr. Monkey.
I think it might be. Yeah.
I'm in tip-top shape today because my water's clean. And no, it's Tread Water. Tread Water is the song.
That's a good pull. I didn't see you going De La Soul in this discussion.
That's what I thought of when you said the goofy animal. Anyway, all right. We got way off base here somehow. But I want to say I feel like it's a win because this is the first podcast in weeks where it won't start with, when I'm writing up the summary, being like, well, we kind of had to get out of the toy department a little.
That's true. We got way into the toy department this time around.
Yeah. Light times. Come to us for your break from all the other stuff, which today we're going to just skip. Just skip it.
Yes, indeed. All right. I think there's only one place to start.
Of course,
this week, which is dare I say, epic finale.
You dare, yes, say
Top
it
Chef.
Because I was going to come on and say that's the best episode of Top Chef I've ever seen. Brought to tears on multiple occasions. At different points of the episode, I found myself rooting for all three of the competitors, and I truly think that is like so. Okay, obviously. Stephanie's, and spoiler alert, by the way, obviously, because the show's over, we're going to talk about it, but Stephanie's entree, the milk-braised veal, was obviously the worst dish, right?
It was the only one that anybody said, where there was a consensus like, this didn't totally
well,
work.
That's what
although
I was going to say.
Although it did seem like Tom was pulling a lot of that weight, I got to say.
Exactly. Almost everybody liked it. And even Tom was like, this was good and the flavor was good. It was just a little bit too much of this and that, right? Like, it was a light critique. I don't know that I've ever seen a single episode of Top Chef where every single thing everyone cooked looked and apparently tasted incredible.
I feel like the finale, you get a little bit more of that vibe.
But there's usually a dud somewhere. And usually it's like, and I guess we could say going into the judgment that it probably had to be Brian or Melissa because of that one dish by Stephanie. But it just seemed like the overall level was so high.
Everyone yeah, it really was.
So good.
Right. You're right. I say that. And look, I think part of that is right because typically the finale is kind of like this one where it's just like cook your best food, you know? And I think everybody comes into it kind of knowing that and having a plan, You know what I mean? Like, this was not one where, like, people were like, I don't really know what to make. You know what I mean?
Though?
Everybody had an idea, right?
Although Melissa's first dish, she
hadn't cooked before, she said.
That's it. That's why she won. As incredible as both Stephanie and Voltaggio's everything looked, and again, apparently tasted, and as much as they finally got Voltaggio to just keep it simple and cook from his heart, Melissa is like creating. I thought it was so fitting that after she was announced, or maybe even, no, it was before they even announced that she was the winner. I think it was her said something to the effect of like, you know, they ask everybody for their final thoughts, and she's like, I just, you know, we're artists here, and I'm glad you appreciate that, basically. And I think that was clear from her all season long. She cooked like an artist all season long. It was beautiful. It was creative. It was original. And she fucking made Dario cry, man. Carne.
That was really something.
I also think we have to talk about
the story, because like Stephanie got tears with the story,
right.
And honestly, no slights to her cooking, because obviously she got a lot of praise. She made three at least, you know, excellent dishes, and one that was just pretty good.
Yeah.
But I thought her storytelling almost was the best weapon of the night for her, really. You know, like I think she really had the room with the explanation of that appetizer.
I think she did too, although it sounded like it was also tremendously cooked, that appetizer.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You know, that helped a lot too.
and I just thought, Stephanie's story. So I nearly cried when she talked about her brother. And then I felt so good for and about her throughout the episode as she like embraced her heart and her talent and felt good about herself and even embraced, you know, being third best. Like,
yeah.
What a great season for her.
I thought a great season for everyone. I have to say, and
Leanne almost screwed it up.
Maybe this is a hot take.
You know, Leanne almost screwed it up.
That's not what I was going to say.
Uh-huh.
I think this is very on brand for you.
Yeah.
But I feel like Melissa was pretty good at just tuning her out. So, and that worked out fine.
That's true.
This is not what I was going to say, but it does remind me. I did think Malarkey was also at his best
yes.
in this challenge.
You know
what I mean?
Well, like, I said to my wife as it started, like, actually, Malarkey might be the best sous chef because he'll give you a suggestion, but he's not going to be a dick about it. And he's so positive and, like, bouncy and eager. Like, that might be a nice vibe for a final, you know, to de-stress you a little bit. I think he was definitely good for Stephanie.
I mean, I think Voltaggio and Kevin were like, I mean, clearly they
were in the zone.
You know, those two guys were going to find each other.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, my hot take was, I have no problem, obviously, with the judgment, and I think we can say Melissa, I think, had the most dominating season that I can recall on this show. Like,
just don't even say what you're about to say.
Incredible.
It's wrong. Just
incredible.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
I think Brian Voltaggio
did
made
not.
The better meal.
He
I
did
do.
Not. He didn't. You're wrong.
I think so.
You're wrong. I'll tell you why. There's two reasons.
Okay.
Number one.
You're gonna say because Melissa was more original, right? But I'm just saying if you're going dish for dish.
It's not just the originality. It's the incredible fusion of the location with her cuisine. In interesting and creative ways. And a tiramisu that made Dario cry. And here's the other thing. If the only dish that didn't get rave reviews was Stephanie's veal, the only other element of a dish that did not get rave reviews was the bread. And if we're grading on this tough a scale, I'm giving him tiny demerit for the bad bread.
I thought the bread was mostly liked, to be honest. Like there was one complaint about the bread, as I recall.
There was
and I would say my counterpoint to you is, yes, you know, Melissa married those two cuisines. And like I said, she was the best chef all season. Like, I'm not, you know, I got no, she's a worthy winner. Like, no complaints on that standpoint. But if we're just talking about this meal today, I would say that Voltaggio married the traditions of Italy with his modernist perspective just as effectively as Melissa merged Asian and Italian cooking within that tradition. Now, he didn't make anybody cry. But if you're going consistency forward, you know, dishes 1 through 2, 3, and 4, I thought he had the best two dishes, and I think Melissa's third dish was better, and dessert was probably even. So,
I don't know if dessert.
That's kind of
even.
Where I landed. You know,
I don't know if dessert was even. She made Dario cry, and he surprised people without putting a liquid filling in his chocolate ball. Like, let's, you know. I would say
no.
They,
that was.
I would
I mean,
say
Gail
going,
talked about how the Grenache was. Look, I mean, look, they, the three of them, they decided that Melissa won. So, like I said, I don't have any problem with it. But
oh,
if
wait,
you're asking
hold on.
Me,
can we talk about?
I think
Voltaggio
made a better meal.
Yeah, it was so close. I honestly, who knows? But I do want to say this because this is important to me. Gail is back. Why is fake ass Gail still here?
You gotta throw them a bone with the free trip to Italy for, you know.
Yeah,
because,
but why
you know,
was
Gail
she
might get pregnant again?
But
you know
why
what I mean?
Was she at judge's table? I don't.
You gotta
I don't
keep
care.
Her in the family.
Okay, so have dinner with all the incredible chefs, even though you don't belong there. But why are you at judge's table?
There's always a fourth person at judge's table.
I know. Look at all
you
the great.
You wanted the carne guy?
Yeah. Give me Dario. Give me the other Italian chef. I thought had some really interesting comments. Give me Marcus Samuelson at judge's table. Fake ass
I don't
Gail.
Have a problem with it. You're just mad because fake ass Gail.
I love calling her fake ass Gail. I honestly don't know her name. I'll never learn that woman's name.
Yeah. Well, it's not a super easy one to learn.
No, I do think it's a tricky name as well. But yeah, no, to me she'll always be fake Gail, and I'm so glad Real Gail is back. Real Gail is so good at this. I love Real Gail.
It's really no, honestly, it's not even slights to fake Gail.
It's no,
just,
it's
not
really
real
not. Real Gail is spectacular. She's just, as much as Padma, like, makes the show, to me, the best judge for the viewer is Gail.
Yeah.
Like, Tom is always, he's so chefy, you know, about his commentary that sometimes for me it's like, all right, dude, fine. Gail, like, really speaks to me in a language that both like respects and elevates the food experience and also is not gibberish.
Mm. She's my third favorite, but she's still great.
you go right to hell. How dare
she's
you?
Still great.
How
I mean, Thomas, Tom, and Padma's Padma. Like, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, but see, you know, this is like, you know what you're like right now. You're like what? One of these National League baseball fans that's all up in arms about the universal DH. Yeah, okay. You could say Tom is Tom and Padma is Padma, but you have no legitimate arguments.
I would say she's the I would say Tom is.
We don't have
a,
to do this. I just wanted to take a shot at the at
all
National
time
baseball.
Successful. I was going to mention this later when we got into the 30 for 30.
Because I'm sure you don't want a universal DH, right?
Well, we've already covered this on the podcast. Yeah. Not only do I not want a universal DH, I'm done. I'm done with you, baseball. I'm over. I'm over it.
Because there's of only, the universal DH, yeah, or because they're a bunch of assholes?
Well, both, but yeah. that doesn't help. But absolutely, like, let's say they were all wonderful people who had settled on this and were like, oh, by the way, universal DH. Peace.
That's so
deuces.
That's so silly to me.
And I get it. Like, we already had this conversation on the pod. It's nothing but an aesthetic preference, but it's my fucking aesthetic preference, and it's really fucking important to me. Yeah. And I'm not interested in watching American League Baseball.
It's
like,
crazy
for the rest
how
of my
many
life.
People
fuck off baseball.
It's crazy how many people are similarly attached to not having a DH.
I'm real attached to it. I have no problem saying it.
No, but like, you're really not
essentially
really
attached
not alone.
To it.
You're really not. Like, you are not. I mean, you might be in the minority, but you're definitely not an outlier.
And I find that fascinating. It's one of the weirdest things in sports to me. It is very baseball for fans to be meaninglessly attached to a silly rule, but I don't get, like, I guess part of me, when people say that, part of the reaction in my brain is, well, how much could you really like baseball then?
Well, here's the thing, is like the simplicity of nine guys versus nine guys. That's like,
but hold on, in the next breath, you're going to tell me how it's important that the manager is forced to use like 12 guys who aren't as good at their jobs for strategy reasons.
I do enjoy that. Yeah. But here's the thing, that was not what I was going to say, by the way.
It's all aesthetic.
Right. Of course. It's all aesthetic. But I guarantee you, like, I am 1,000% sure that if you had grown up primarily watching National League Baseball, that you would feel exactly the same way. Because you like this. You like this product.
No, but there is a difference. I'm glad we're doing this, because I'm not sure the last time we talked about it, I'm not sure I was clear about where I really stand on this, because your adamant insistence upon not having a DH puts me in a position where I'm arguing the other side. I truly could not care less if the National League has a DH or not. The two different types of baseball are meaninglessly distinguishable to me. I don't care at all about the difference. If they got rid of the DH entirely, I would think it was stupid, but I would not be super upset about it. I just think the fervor for continuing to have people who can't hit is silly. That's all.
It's not about continuing to have people who can't hit. It's kind of like the thing where, like, when you talk about a sport and you say, like, well, how stupid is it that we care about a guy swinging a wooden stick while somebody throws the ball and the da, 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 and then they run around? And you know what I mean? Like, any sport, when you break it down to here's literally what's happening, sounds stupid. The reality is that baseball is a regional sport, right? And people grow up with their teams and their traditions and that's a huge part of the romance of the game. And the not having a DH is one of the things that makes the National League the National League. And guess what? People who like the National League like the National League. They don't want to watch the other league, or they already would be doing it. So it's not even about really, like, is the DH a better way to play the game? Because obviously it isn't. So what are we even talking about? Like, we're just talking about the thing that makes the thing that you like it isn't. Like,
what
is
do you
better,
mean obviously
right?
It isn't? I don't think it's better.
I didn't really mean obviously it isn't. That wasn't my point. That was a joke.
I'm truly indifferent. That's the thing. I don't think one is better than the other. I think the differences are meaningless and aesthetic. That's what I'm saying. So,
yes.
Like, I'm not arguing that DH baseball is better baseball. I'm saying the argument that without the DH, baseball is infinitely better and more strategic is ridiculous. That's all.
It's not about infinitely. You know what it is?
So,
it's keep Portland weird, man. That's what it is.
Well,
that's all it is.
And I can't argue with that. So, like, I don't have a problem with your argument. We did this on the radio too, and both Damon and Ray are essentially in the camp of, like, I enjoy the differences between the leagues because it's quirky. It's okay, fair enough, but I don't think that's a compelling reason to do anything necessarily. You know, to me, it's not as stupid as a pole in the middle of center field, but it's the same genre.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't, you know, I just think that, like, you know, people laugh at, like, double switches and whatever, but, like, my God, that, like, nothing happens in American League games except just people running around bases. Like, I hate living in an American League city and being forced to watch DH baseball all the time, and now that's all there is. It sucks.
Yeah, except I don't really think that's not DH baseball. That's modern baseball, and that's a separate problem to me. You have to figure out a way to make the game not be three true outcomes. And look, we don't have time to fix baseball on this podcast. I don't think we even have time to get them playing in the calendar year of 2020.
Isn't it amazing how, like, we Brockmire strove to be prescient, I think, about so many things in, like, our society, particularly in this last season. And I think the take on baseball is probably going to prove to be the most prescient of all those things.
No, I disagree. The least prescient. They had baseball lasting till like 2040. Good luck, man.
Baseball's a sad state. I think we can leave it at that.
Do you want to transition, or should we do the challenge first, or you want to transition into the baseball thing? Because I think we can just tie our discussion of Long Gone Summer onto the end of all the stupidity that baseball abounds in, because this is a very stupid, and I am using heavy finger quotes here, documentary.
Yeah, I agree. Real quick, is there anything else you wanted to add about Top Chef? Because it was delightful.
It was delightful. I mean, it really was one of my favorite episodes of Top Chef ever. I was happy with the outcome, and I was proud of all three chefs for the way they performed. It gave me all the feels. This is why I watch Top Chef. Everything here. Beautiful food, moving stories, emotions running high. This was it.
Yep, it's good as reality TV gets. I did also enjoy that the family calls.
Yeah.
I had no idea that Kristen Kish and Stephanie were best friends.
That's cool.
That was really great. And I love that Michael Potasio had, like, no idea what's going on.
Wait, you're on Top Chef again?
What's happening? Oh, it's the finale. Good job.
That was incredible.
And I do wonder, I know he said he's not coming back, but I almost have to wonder if, like, three seasons and three trips to the finale, you know what I mean?
Am
like,
I
if
crazy?
That doesn't eat
Didn't,
at Brian Voltaggio at some point.
Yeah, okay. Didn't Leanne, like, 3 weeks ago say she's never coming back? So we'll see, okay? I'll believe it when I see it, big guy. I don't know. You know, it seems like the pull of Top Chef is strong. But I'll tell
you
what, Melissa,
I really feel like my warning of, yeah, Melissa's not coming back. She's done. You know, look, man, none of these people may have restaurants anymore. That might really change stuff. Clearly it's going to be a long time before we have another season of Top Chef. So who knows?
Right? Or not. I don't know. I mean, I don't like going places and having guests is hard, but can you just test and quarantine 20 chefs?
I think it's difficult to film a television show under social distancing
They've already got waivers going out and everything for TV and movies. They're starting back up again as soon as California lets them.
Maybe we'll see.
You know, we'll see.
They tend to take a while between shows normally.
Anyway, yeah, it was like a year anyway.
Yeah, so it you know, it could be a minute before we see Top Chef again. But yeah, you're right. Congratulations to Melissa. Like I said, it feels like, and this could be recency bias, but it does feel like the greatest season long performance in the show's history to me. Like, she won
she
the last
dominant.
Four challenges. Is that right?
I don't
the
know if that's
four
a,
elimination
maybe the last
challenges.
Three, but
it was three coming into the show. Yeah, so it's four.
Oh, if yeah, this ca- yeah,
she, I mean that's.
And she just, other than like a two-episode dip after Restaurant Wars, she was just clearly the best all season long.
Yeah. Yeah, she was. And good for her.
Yeah.
I don't think that was anything that people necessarily saw coming. She was good on her season, but nowhere near this good. And incredible growth and... Just either, you know, like, you know, it's a little flex when she was like, oh, yeah, you know, I spent a couple years making pasta at Delfina. Which is one of the best and most storied restaurants in San Francisco. So I'm like, oh, where else have you just casually worked at? No wonder you're amazing.
Right.
So good for Melissa. And really, just a bonkers great season of Top Chef.
And, really a great season, and what a tremendous finale.
Yeah. All right, now let's get to this crappy baseball documentary. What the hell happened here?
I honestly don't know, because I don't know the director of this, right? Like, I don't even know his name offhand. But I don't know how a self-respecting human being could make this film, a self-respecting documentarian, because you're ignoring the story the whole way through, and you're signing up to have at least one pompous prick lie to you and another guy kind of shrug it off. So I don't know what, and like, I guess there are people who will say I'm presuming something when I say Maguire's lying to the camera, but I don't believe what he's saying. And he sells himself out as soon as he says, sure, I took steroids and hit 70 homers, but I didn't need them. It's like, what are we talking about here? Oh, it was just about recovering from injuries. No big deal. Like, I honestly, if we hadn't planned to watch it here and I hadn't, you know, sort of needed to watch it for work, I would have turned it off about 20 minutes in when the lady who was like a front office worker for the Cubs said essentially, well, you know, that was the summer where Sammy got really interested in nutrition.
I missed that line. That's like, great.
Are you kidding me right
and
now?
And cork.
No, that was later. He didn't get the corked bat was like 3 years later.
Well, he was caught 3 years later. Doesn't mean he wasn't using one.
No, I know. This is the point I'm making.
Yeah.
That seems to be the approach the documentary took, is like, well, if they say it, it's good enough for me. And then at the end, here's what I really couldn't believe. And what, frankly, drives me up a wall. I've come around a little bit on Bob Costas in general just because he's so damn good. I've never been a huge fan of his pedantic manner, frankly. For Bob Costas and TJ Quinn, who I am generally a fan of, to sit there and be like, yeah, I mean, they probably did some stuff, but who cares? It was fun. I felt like they must have had TJ Quinn at gunpoint. I couldn't believe, I could not believe he was sitting there. And then the thing that pissed me off the most about this, and that's a hell of an accomplishment because I hate watched the vast majority of it. The unmitigated fucking Bud Selig infused gall to when you finally mention the stain of steroids and performance enhancing drugs to have Barry Bonds on the screen.
I didn't pick up on that. I suppose it could have happened.
Come on. Come on. When in fact Bonds had already been on the screen earlier in someone else's highlight, and you could plainly see he was like half their size.
Yeah.
Like, the story's written. Barry Bonds started taking illegal drugs because he was
after
pissed off
yeah.
that these two jokers juiced themselves up and broke records and stole all the attention when he was the best player in the game by far. Like,
yeah.
So
I think you could make an argument for Griffey, and I had the thought at some point.
You're right. One of the two best players
in
the game.
At some point, I had a thought of, wow, like this story from Ken Griffey's perspective, as these two cheats, you know what I mean, like continue to sail past him in August, you know, as he's getting tired, you know. Like, that would have been a much more interesting documentary, I think.
Absolutely.
And this, which was kind of like, just, hey, remember some stuff that happened? That was mostly it. Like, we're not going to take any stance on the stuff that happened. We're just, here's some things that happened.
And not only here's some things that happened, but here's some things that happened. And by the way, don't worry about that other stuff that you also know happened at exactly the same time. We're not talking about that right now.
Yeah, so I'd seen on Twitter that the steroid thing didn't get mentioned until the last 10 minutes. So I was kind of prepared for that coming in. So I didn't quite have the same sort of, you know, incendiary reaction. But it's just such a weird choice that I presume was necessitated by getting Maguire and Sosa's participation.
But then you don't make, and that's my point about the director. Like, there's two thing. There are two options here in my mind. You either make a movie about this summer where everyone is honest, or you don't make a movie. Because this is not a movie. This is a baseball highlight tape. If this was an hour-long special on the summer of 98 airing on MLB Network, fair enough. But it's supposed to be a 30 for 30 documentary.
Yeah. And that's kind of it. It kind of felt more like that, like something that MLB media put together.
It's what's his name? It's not Matt Foley. What's the Chris Farley character who does the talk show?
I think it is Matt Foley.
No, he's the van down by the river.
Oh, you're right. Isn't it? Is it just the Chris Farley? Is he playing himself?
It might just be the Chris Farley show. Yeah. But that's what this was. You remember that time where you hit all those home runs? That was cool.
And even that was like, you know, not none of that stuff was particularly revelatory. There were a few things where I was like, oh, I kind of forgot about this.
Right.
You know what I mean? But like some of the details. But no, none of it
really was
like,
bad. The 30 for 30. Did you ever watch Lance?
I did, yes. I don't think we wound up talking about it, did we?
No, I don't think we did. But I think the downward trajectory and quality of the ESPN Sunday night programming has been precipitous.
Yeah, I would agree.
The Last Dance was great. I thought Lance was really good. Bruce Lee was mediocre. And this was downright bad, if you ask me.
Yep. Pretty much in that order.
So I guess it makes sense that there are – I don't believe there is anything specific planned for next Sunday.
It's probably good. Like, you know, obviously we sort of had this discussion already. But, man, and you know, irrespective of my feelings about the DH, which are strong and I'm completely serious about, baseball's in real trouble, right?
Yep.
Like –
I really think
whether they decide to play or not to play, like they've just lost the plot.
Well,
you know what I
mean? At the beginning of this mess, they sort of had a chance to seize the summer, right? They could have been the first ones back, you know, potentially. They could have had some attention that they might otherwise.
Been Korean baseball, man.
Yeah. Like things could have been, it could have been better. And then that would have potentially been a chance to grab some new eyeballs, right? And instead, you're likely playing, if you play at all, first of all, you're doing it on the heels of this nasty fight where you both embarrassed yourselves, but especially the owners embarrassed themselves. Then you are playing against a condensed, all-day-long action, already more popular NBA season. And I just, if things like the Universal DH piss off actual baseball fans, I don't see how you're possibly getting new eyes under these circumstances.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's just, it's tough.
DH, no DH, pitching changes in the middle of an inning or no, like these are not things that are going to get kids to watch this game. You know, like they're not.
No, I think the things you need to do to get kids to watch the game, ironically, are not to make new changes, but to do what you can to make the game look more like it used to. And I have not thought enough about it, but I do think the answer here lies in starting not with the proposition of like our games are too long or there's not enough scoring, but with the idea that there's way too little in-play action in our sport right now. So much of the sport is essentially stopped after the bat hits the ball.
Yeah.
It's homers, it's strike, or it doesn't hit the ball. It's strikeouts, homers, walks, and nobody's stealing. And so
I mean, you're making an argument for deadening the ball, basically, right? Like, that's what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't know if it's deadening the ball or, you know, I mean, I think shifts probably could use a look. Like, there's a handful of things.
Yeah.
And like I said, I haven't thought enough about it. But to me, it's not about shortening the games or increasing scoring. It's about reducing the time people are standing around.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's hard. Like, I have a hard time with the idea of outlawing shifts. I feel like
so do I.
Where people stand on defense seems like that's one of the main points of defense, right? You know what I mean? So
I wouldn't want to outlaw shifts either, but like, it would not be insane to have some rules about where folks are allowed to stand, because like, that's not like, here's the thing. That sounds insane because it's not how baseball works, but it's not an insane concept from like a sporting perspective. Like, there's rules about where people
have
to stand.
Well,
there's rules about where people have to stand in all sorts of sports, right?
Yeah.
You have to stand in the batter's box when you're hitting. You know, you're not allowed to stand on the plate, but fielders can stand wherever they want. I don't know. It's not that there's anything fundamentally wrong with the baseball's bones. It's that the way analytics have developed the game have sort of shown us that it has incentivized boring stuff.
Yeah. That's hard for me to admit as an analytics lover, but it's true.
I love analytics too, and analytics is the right way to go. It is the most efficient way to play baseball, but like, the way to fix that is to make it less obvious what the most efficient way to play baseball is by changing either rules or, like you said, deadening the ball. Like, there's things you can do. I don't know how you make steals worthwhile again, but I'm sure there's a way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only way to do it would be right. It's steals went out of the game because it was realized it wasn't a good percentage play, right? So like, they'd have to become a good percentage play, I think, for teams to want to invest in them again,
right?
And I don't really know how that happens.
Well, except that neither do I. But what I'm saying is, if I was in charge of the sport of baseball, those are the questions I'd be asking.
Yeah.
How do
Fair
I
enough.
Re-incentivize the most exciting plays in our game? Because all the most exciting stuff happens with the ball in play. Even the most exciting homers, for the most part. I mean, look, it's fun every now and then when someone hits a moonshot, right? But it's almost more exciting if you're not sure if it's going out or not. If a guy has a chance to make a play on it and bring it back. Like, all the most exciting things in baseball happen with the ball in play, and the sport has incentivized taking the ball out of play, basically.
Yeah, that much is correct. I don't know if any of that is going to fix it, and I don't know that it doesn't seem like
– I don't think they're going to
you know,
try
you're,
anyway.
You're talking about systemic changes in
a
world that's entrenched. Okay, much like our discussion has gone on some detours here.
Yeah.
Spike Lee put out.
Wait, hold on.
Here.
We got to go back to the challenge before that.
Okay. All right. Right. Challenge. Yes.
So what stood out to you the most about this episode?
Not a ton, to be honest.
I agree, but one thing stuck out like a sore thumb to me.
Okay, hit me.
The edits around D.
Oh, you know, I wasn't really looking for those, but you're right. There was very, very little D.
There was no D. And last week, it was less noticeable because she wasn't as involved.
Yes, to me it was more right. Like, to me it was more noticeable last week because the ending revolved around her. Yet it was a shorter show, and she was almost not in it. Right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but
I guess this one she wasn't essential to any results, and so it was just
dude. She
easy to
was
cut her.
She was in the tribunal.
Oh yeah, shit. You're right.
And that's how little she did. They did not put her. At the end of the race, Anissa was racing D, wasn't she? And they didn't show D on screen one time.
Yeah. I guess that's what it's just going to be, right? That's just what they're going
to
do.
I don't think there's any other way to interpret it. She has been cut out of the show, even though she's a major participant in it, and it's awkward, man.
Yeah. I think they may need to reconsider that. You're already running the disclaimer, you know?
Yeah.
Most people, I don't know. You're right. And I would say this too, this kind of dovetails with the thing that I was going to sort of say, is that I think we've reached a point just from the game where a lot of the best house competitors are gone.
What do you mean house competitors?
Like the best characters on the show.
Okay.
You know what I mean? You got Bananas obviously still running around.
He is so funny.
But like,
he is old, like old reserved Bananas is my favorite. It's so yeah. good.
But a lot of the other just like, I'm delighted whenever they're on screen, people are gone. You know, there's a little bit of Kyle who's still kind of
Kyle
playing the periphery.
Kyle finally realized he's going to have to go into an elimination. Yeah. And now there may not be one.
Like Josh didn't figure out to the very end of the episode for some reason.
Unbelievable.
Like Josh is enjoyable TV in that he's just so fucking clueless. You know what I mean?
It's wild. He like nobody leans harder into the caricature of themselves than Josh. And he has no idea he's doing it.
Nope.
But
and
like
people seem to enjoy him.
Yeah, but they're all like he's an emotional wreck and he doesn't know what he's talking about. And then they laugh. And he becomes an emotional wreck who doesn't know what he's talking about. It's so funny. And it's a never, it's a vicious circle. It just keeps happening. It really is wonderful. What did you think about the elimination?
I thought that, I mean, it was certainly one of the more entertaining in that it was, you know, really down to the wire.
Yes.
I mean, I can't say I'm super surprised at the outcome.
No, but I thought Corey got really lucky because I don't think he could have like run. You know, the guy's got a sprained ankle and it's a challenge where you literally don't use your feet. You're floating, you're swinging around in the air.
Yeah, that's a pretty good break. Like, and it was something that Swaggy had zero experience at.
Totally.
Clearly, like, stumbled a little bit.
Well, and I think being tall is a disadvantage when you're swinging in one of those harnesses. So I think that probably hurt Swaggy a little bit. But, yeah, I thought Corey got it. It was like the opposite of Jordan getting stuck with a pole wrestle, you know?
Yeah. Although, look, you know, if the ankle doesn't get better, that's going to get catching up with him.
Yeah, but you know he's got. Well, I don't know how long actually goes on between these challenges, but like he's got some time because they're not going to send him in again.
I don't think it's that long, to be honest. And we know from the trailer, you know that the finale. I mean, look, it's not a surprise the finale is going to be a test of endurance, but they're like you know climbing mountains and stuff, right?
Yeah, we saw him. We saw him in the snow.
There's a lot of stuff that the ankle. If you got a bad ankle,
it's tough, you might
have some problems. Yeah. So,
but you know what? I still have him ahead of Anissa if they go to the final. Like when the moment Anissa in that like you know sled pulling. In that sled pulling, when she was like, you know, I'm trying to set a good pace for myself, I was like, oh, boy, we're in trouble here. God bless her. I'm a fan, but man alive. She's
somehow going to make it to the end of this thing.
You might be right. And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, the final part of the final might be one of those crazy equalizing challenges, and then she's the winner. So who the hell knows?
Yeah. You know, I'm surprised we haven't had a lot of talk about people trying to hold layups, you know, for the final, which has been a strategy in seasons past. And maybe the Red Skull thing sort of flipped that on its head. I don't know.
I don't think it flipped it on its head strategically. I think it flipped it on its head because layups can't get to the final.
Yeah.
All the layups got eliminated. I mean, Big T eliminated herself, but all the layups went into an elimination and got eliminated by a better player who was like, you know what they did? Instead of saving the eliminations for the final, they used the layups for the final. They used the layups to get their skulls.
Right. Everyone wanted to go in
against the layups, right, exactly, when they could. Oftentimes not always realizing what the layups were, though.
Yeah. So, yeah. But that's always true anyway, right? So someone's always wrong about who they think is a layup.
Indeed. Indeed. Sometimes they think it's Johnny Bananas. I don't know. I think I'm a little bit concerned about the if this episode is a harbinger for what's to come. I think you made a really excellent point about D, because this episode was awkward. Last episode was awkward, and just less entertaining. They need to get a handle on it.
They do, and it almost makes me wonder if they. See, but I just don't see how she could be about to be eliminated.
I don't. Yeah, I mean, maybe they must know something. It's such a weird choice. Everyone understands the show was taped before,
right,
the comments, right? So, and you've made your statement. You cut ties with her. I don't get the why you need the extra step of like pretending that she doesn't exist.
Neither do I, especially because the comments were like. There are comments she could have made that, to me, would make this level of editing like, all right, I don't really want to see her face, right? But these comments were, like, stupid and ignorant, but not, like, horrifying.
No.
Right? I mean, maybe I'm missing it. I don't know.
I'll tell you, like, I think I said this last week, like, it won't shock me if
she's back in
three, four years. You know what I mean? Like, down the road. They bring her back because she's been good TV and she's pretty connected within that world. And then these episodes look even dumber. So
it's weird.
Yeah. Some curious choices by MTV. Although I will say it's setting up for one of the more interesting reunions.
Yeah, it is.
Although that's right. She won't be there. So that's just going to be a pylon. It would be my guess, right? That's how they'll handle that.
I wonder, man, you never know. Someone could end up defending her. What does Wes have to say about it? I'm interested in a lot about that.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you Wes will say something smart, but that doesn't put him on the side of racism. You know what I mean?
No,
like,
of
Wes,
course he will,
Wes
but
is smart,
I'm interested to see that, you know, balancing act. I don't know. There's a lot to this. What do Bailey and Swaggy say about it? You know, I mean, let's be serious. The challenge is not a very colorful show historically. And the two people who are black on the challenge who spent a lot of time around D are going to be at that reunion. So I'm interested.
Sadly, I'd say the challenge is more colorful than most of reality TV, to be honest. Which is not saying that it's a super colorful show.
Yeah, I mean, right.
But when you compare it to some others,
that's probably true.
And certainly for longer, right?
No doubt they've had like 1 to 3 people of color on most seasons of the challenge over time.
1 to 3 black people, right? Typically, they've been I feel like they've been fairly, you know, like you look, there's Asians and Latinos in this cast. And we're also not counting, like, what's Casey? I don't think we actually even know. You know what I mean?
You're right. It's
a couple ways you can go there.
It's white, but it's a lot more diverse than most reality TV. That's certainly true.
Especially, like, you know, compare that to, say, The Bachelor.
Wow. Don't worry. That's fixed. They got a black bachelor now. Have you been listening to Higher Learning?
I have not been listening to Higher Learning, and I've been kind of wondering if I should. So it sounds like maybe you have.
Strong recommend. Okay. I'm a big fan of Van Lathan. We had him on our show last week, I think it was.
I'm a big fan of Rachel Lindsay.
And Rachel Lindsay is a really interesting, smart lady, too, and they have fun. They talk about real shit, but they're really good. I think it's really good.
I was actually also thinking about checking out Way Down in the Hole, so maybe I'll just double up on Van Lathan.
Yeah, see, I always imagine I'm going to watch that when I next rewatch The Wire, but who knows when I'll have time.
I don't know, man. It's I think we're headed to the TV hole pretty soon. We're going to have to start coming up with rewatches for this show. So
yeah, that's true.
So who knows? Maybe we'll do The Wire again, or maybe I'll actually get you in on The Americans this time.
No, you won't do that. But I would not be opposed to like an episode by episode rewatch of The Wire. That's for sure.
All right. Okay. Sounds good. Can we talk about the Five Bloods?
Yeah.
I feel like I like this movie more than most, at least from what I've heard. Like, I found it really enjoyable, but I do get the idea that maybe it was doing a little too much. You know, like there's a lot happening, and I think in the hands of a less skilled director, this could have been a total mess.
I think that's really well said. The way I had sort of phrased it in my head is that for a Spike Lee joint, this is very messy. But because it's Spike Lee, I kind of take that as deliberate. He's such a technician, usually, you know? And this film felt less precise than the average Spike Lee joint. Does that make sense?
See, I've been really been enjoying late period Spike Lee.
Uh-huh.
This is a weird comparison, I think, in a lot of ways. And it only holds up in this one sense. But I think as an artist, had a fair amount of Brian Malarkey in him. You know what I mean? Like, where he sometimes, you know, the skill is there, but I think sometimes he does say too much and the plate gets a little loud and the plate gets a little messy. You know, because he's just like, this is not uncommon to me when you look at Black Klansman or She's Gotta Have It, the TV
okay,
show.
Messy might be the wrong word then. Like, less precise? I don't know. It just, like, it's not like Spike Lee's Wes Anderson, okay? But this jumbled, but not in a bad way. This just felt like maybe part of the point of it was there's a lot of chaos here. To me.
Maybe that was part of the point. I feel like he was just trying to, you know, like, I'm going to make a war movie. It's going to have some references to a lot of my favorite war movies. And right. Then
there were some,
and also sort of tell this story. Yeah. And it was, a lot of it was really cool. And I found it a really enjoyable, watchable experience that I would recommend.
Yep.
It's just, it's kind of like
long.
Yeah. It's just and long. It's a lot. And there's a lot happening. It goes a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, and it sort of reminds me, it's like, you know, like I really enjoyed Black Klansman. And then you know, it takes this crazy turn at the end, you know, where, some people liked it and some people didn't, you know what I mean? Like that, I feel like is a hallmark of late period Spike.
Maybe you're right. But this, to me, this felt different than most Spike Lee movies, but I enjoyed it for the most part. It was very long. And it was a lot. I'll also say this. My number one takeaway from this movie is I need more Delroy Lindo in my life. Like, what do I have to do? Do I have to watch The Good Fight? Is that what you're telling me? I can't get Delroy Lindo in more movies? Like, the guy is spectacular, man.
My take was that Delroy Lindo's gotten a raw deal.
Like, yeah.
Should have been giving him better parts.
Seriously. I truly don't get it. It's not like we didn't know Delroy Lindo was awesome.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, to be honest.
Crooklyn was 1994. That is 26 years ago. We know how good Delroy Lindo is. Why is this his best role since Crooklyn? You know?
What was that? I would vouch for Get Shorty.
No, Get Shorty, Clockers was after
that. That was
96.
Yeah.
And he had some other ones. Heist is a really good movie that he has a good little part in 2001, but just it's not enough. There's not enough Delroy Lindo.
No. Hey, he's doing parts on, I'm looking at his IMDb now, and like Law and Order and like the Chicago Code. And
yeah, I don't know, man.
Like what's happening here? Like, this guy's a treasure.
I don't know. I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me. But he was awesome in this. And playing a really, I think, tricky part.
Yeah, for sure. You know, charismatic and, you know, kind of, you know, in the same way, like a lot of people sort of talked about the guy on Ozark, who, you know, the brother on Ozark and, and how that could have gone really badly. I think the difficulty in playing this guy, you know, suffering from the fog of war in war, that could have gone really poorly, particularly those like scenes directly into the into the camera.
Yeah.
And he just crushed him, you know?
No, I mean, that's the thing. A guy staring into the camera from a foot away, speaking what amounts to gibberish, is a really dangerous thing.
Yeah.
You really got to be good. And if you don't nail it, it's going to seem so goofy. And that, to me, was probably my favorite part of the movie. Like, I was mesmerized by that whole... And that was a long stretch where it's just Delroy Lindo stumbling through the jungle talking into the camera. And he's so good.
Yeah, he's great. And I really like Clark Peters, too. I thought was excellent. But that's,
Clark Peters is always wonderful.
He's doing his Clark Peters thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it literally could have been like, Lester Freeman, good to see ya. That's his character.
But you know
what?
It is always good to see Lester Freeman.
It is. I love seeing Lester Freeman. But it could have been Lester... Like, if Lester was in Vietnam before he became a Baltimore cop, that's his story, you know? I also think anytime you can get Clay Davis to give you a shit, it's a good day.
I feel like he was, like, once he was cast, they're like, all right, we got to find a reason for you to say shit.
We got
to
drop it in. We got to find a way. Yeah.
And he said it with gusto too, which is really good.
Yeah, you know, it'd be like bringing Red Panda out at the halftime show and not having her juggle bowls. You know what I'm saying? Like that's why she's here.
Right, right. You know it.
We all know it. Sure, he's a good actor. I got nothing. Like he's great. It was.
I feel like he did a scene in like Cedar Rapids.
Yeah, that's just part of it now. That's just part of what you do now. Sorry.
Yeah, kind of underrated movie, by the way, Cedar Rapids, I feel like.
Yeah.
You know what I didn't think was underrated? The King of Staten Island.
You did not think was underrated. Okay.
Yeah. I feel like it's pretty mediocre, to be honest, and my expectations were kind of high. I love Apatow. Really enjoyed Pete Davidson. Having some familiarity with Pete Davidson's life story, it seemed like fertile ground for a movie, and there are some interesting subtle things that are happening. I thought Marissa Tomei was really good in not the hugest part, but it's
talk about
just,
other people that are always wonderful. She's a national treasure, and she's 55 years old. She looks incredible.
Another person who needs more to do, I feel like. But yeah, like at just the end of the day, it's just not that funny, this movie.
You know, maybe oddly, maybe not. It reminded me a ton of Big Time Adolescence. Just a ton.
Yeah, but I liked Big Time Adolescence more. Did you?
Well, I guess maybe it just wasn't as impactful the second time around.
Yeah, like, it could be that.
Pete Davidson plays stoner lacking direction in life who goes through some shit and starts to figure himself out, but we kind of leave it open-ended. It's kind of an interesting, you know, slice of life tale without a real ending. And
yeah.
I liked it. You know, I liked it fine. This had all the hallmarks of what might be called late stage Apatow, which like is not really necessarily just comedies. You know, when's the last time he actually directed a feature film?
It's been a while.
Is it
he hasn't made
funny
that many
people?
Movies.
It might be funny, people. And that, I think tonally, was kind of like this.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. In terms and, you know, of and like, I know he's going for a specific thing. And sorry, you know, when I say it just wasn't that funny, like, I wasn't expecting super bad.
No, no.
You know what I mean?
This
like, I knew 40. It wasn't that kind of movie.
The last one was This Is 40, and the one before that was Funny People. So, like, his last couple movies, movies that he directed are, you know, pretty, I don't know quite how to put it. Like, they're not even comedy. They're funny. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Train wreck is in there.
I was going to say the answer is train wreck.
Yeah. And that was a stupid comedy. So 5 years that ago. Shows yeah. you how smart I am. But I still
Unless
think.
Unless you're counting the Avett Brothers documentary he made in 2017.
I am not. The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling was really pretty incredible.
That was good, actually.
But documentary is different. In terms of, you know, narrative films he's directed, this fits in the funny people and, you know, This Is 40 sort of dialect for me of funny people, no pun intended, and some funny moments, but not essentially comedies.
Right.
And I, like, this wasn't a bad movie, but it just, it's almost like Big Time Adolescence was like a practice shoot, and then they did this, and it just doesn't work as well for me because I already saw Big Time Adolescence.
Yeah, and I don't know. I feel like other of those movies in that vein just had more to say about the world than this one did.
Agreed. And part of that, I think, is really what this was about was Pete Davidson. And
yeah,
I think maybe the problem is Pete Davidson, like, should have written this movie in 10 years. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I could potentially see that. It's the other thing is, like, I mean, think about how much we loved Love. You know? Which I think balanced sort of both of those ideas of, you know, not necessarily, like, comedy coming out of not necessarily funny situations, and then some just straight up comedy. And I don't know, it's just miles more effective than this, which again, I'm really dumping on it. I didn't think it was that bad. I just didn't think it was that good. So,
yeah. And I actually thought, so, all right, this brings us to what I think is an important question for these discussions is, like, does Pete Davidson belong at the center of TV of movies? Because I guess if here's maybe what I'm getting at. If this was supposed to be the announcement of Pete Davidson as a guy who can carry a movie, I think they did it wrong. Because you're not showing me that he can do anything besides a very Pete Davidson-y thing.
Yeah, I...
Like, this just isn't an opportunity.
I hate to say it because I like Pete Davidson, but I think the answer is no. I feel like the answer is he's kind of showing us no. He's showing us he can be Pete Davidson. He's showing us he can be the quirky best friend in a movie.
Yes.
I think he could nail that role. Yes. But if you're talking about, like, can this guy act his way through a movie, the answer has to be no, right?
Well, the answer certainly has to be this isn't how you would show us that. Right. Yeah. I mean, that to me is the biggest thing is, like, if what you wanted to prove to me was you can carry a movie full stop, you didn't do that. What I've seen is you can be engaging as essentially yourself on screen. And that's valuable. Don't get me wrong. Like, not everyone can do that, but that doesn't make you a movie star.
Right. And look, you can watch a lot of Adam Sandler movies, specific Adam Sandler movies, and go, there's a guy who can't really carry a movie. And then you know,
he clearly can.
That same guy can be capable of Uncut Gems and Punch Drunk Love and, you know, a couple great balls out comedies, you know, as well. You know what I mean? So
most people don't when you say that, I don't know if you really mean it. What you're really saying is Adam Sandler's made some bad movies. I'm not sure you ever looked at
lot of bad movies.
Yeah.
A lot of bad movies.
But they're bad because they're dumb and overly simple and the jokes are stupid, but not because he's not a movie star. Like,
yeah, you may be right. Maybe you're right.
Adam Sandler's a movie star. And I think we knew that from the first time we saw him in a movie, right? Like, in Billy Madison, it's like, oh, this guy's a movie star.
Yeah. You're right. And even if he's doing like, what was the football one?
Yeah, La Longest Yard.
That wasn't the football.
Oh, the water boy? The
water boy. Yeah, thank you. Like, you know, like mid-grade Sandler stuff.
Yes, he's still
a movie star. Yeah.
That's the thing. Right. And so that's why I'm not. I think a lot of people had this pegged as like Pete Davidson. Look, he can be a movie star. And I don't see it yet. And I'm rooting for him, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not in him.
Could be.
But yeah, you're right. He hasn't totally shown it yet, to be honest. Even though we liked Big Time Adolescents.
Right. But you know, there's something different about being at the center of a quirky indie as a quirky guy than being a movie star.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's like, you know, even this might sound silly, and he's not exactly Leonardo DiCaprio, but like when Joseph Gordon-Levitt does 500 Days of Summer, you know, you're like, oh, that guy's kind of a star.
I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt's a really good actor.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just saying he's not Brad Pitt, but there's like a magnetism that it doesn't seem to be part of what Pete Davidson is doing in these two movies. And I don't know if that's because of the movies or because it's just not his thing.
Yeah. He's got like a new, it's almost sounds like an action flick coming out, by the way, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, that maybe we'll have to talk about if we can find it on demand at some point.
I watched part of Inception the other day. Like, he's just really good in everything he's in, man.
Yeah. Well, and especially the Nolan stuff.
Yeah.
But even like, you know, stuff like, was it, I want to say Win-Win, but I think it was like 50-50. Is that right?
50-50 with Seth Rogen. Yeah. Really good.
Yeah.
The Lookout. He was really good as like a kid with a brain injury. He's.
Did you ever see Brick?
Yeah. Really bizarre movie, but quite the guy who made Brick made something else. That guy's famous now. Who is it? Who made Brick?
Oh
it's Ryan Johnson. It's Ryan Johnson.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. interesting career that guy's going on to have.
Sure has.
I'm in his corner though.
Yeah.
All right. That's pretty much everything's up to 8:46, right? We should jump into that real quick.
Oh, right. I had forgotten. Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't put that in the homework last week, but, you know, Chappelle drops a new special.
Well, it literally dropped as we were talking last week.
Yeah. Yeah. So which is pretty wild.
I watched it after I posted last week's episode. When I went to Twitter to post the episode, everyone was like, oh, my God, Dave Chappelle. And it took me a minute to figure it out where to find it. But yeah, once I did, I watched it immediately.
So I still don't, just real quick, I still don't totally understand that because it's on Netflix's YouTube channel.
Yeah,
is that
weird.
Correct?
Yeah.
But not on regular Netflix.
Right. And I don't know what that's about.
I do not either. I don't. Why would you not put it on regular Netflix?
I asked the same question and I have not received a satisfactory answer.
So I didn't totally get that one. I don't think we have to spend a ton of time on this.
Well, anything we say about it is going to lead us out of the toy department ultimately. But
yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of, we've talked about this before. I've had a lot of different personal experiences with Chappelle in my life. And this fits into some of those that lean less on the funny and more just on him talking. And it's always interesting.
To quote Van Jones, not Van Jones, damn it.
Van Latham.
Did I call him Van Jones earlier too?
I did not. You did not, no.
To quote Van Latham, he's just one of the most effective communicators we've ever seen.
Yep.
He's a great communicator. And I think he finds, at least I always find when I listen to him talk, that he finds really smart ways to analogize or explain or what have you, to make things hit home. And I think this is a time, and the subject matter he covered is a subject matter where, in particular, black people have been struggling for literally hundreds of years to make the message hit home. And I thought he was really smart and effective at communicating the message. Now, you know, I've thought other people have been over the years too, but he's got a huge platform, a huge voice. A lot of people love him, and I think he said some really powerful stuff. And a couple times really made me laugh.
Yeah, only a couple. Yep. but they were great when they happened.
He never lets you totally forget that he's a comedic genius.
Yeah. Yeah. And a true master of delivery, which I think speaks to the communicator part that you were kind of talking about. Like, he just knows how to deliver a line, whether it's a joke or whether it's a point that makes you think, you know?
Well, and he understands like setup and punchline in a way that extends to, meaningful monologue just as well as it works for jokes. You know, when he started, what was the thing? Was he talking about, the earthquake? He started talking about the earthquake, and you're like, where is he going with this?
Yeah, I did not see him the way he circled that back around.
Like, he's like, for 30 seconds during this earthquake, I was terrified.
Yeah.
And then you realize for 8:46, the man had a knee on his neck, and how excruciating that must have been mentally. Never mind the physical excruciation, which caused death. Like, his last moments were horrifying mentally.
Yeah.
And it's just that's an example of the thing I'm talking about, where, like, who would have thought that a weird story, semi-analogy to a random earthquake experience would somehow make the George Floyd death hit me even harder?
Yeah. Well, and I think we've been asked to sort of imagine that 8:46 in lots of different ways over the last few weeks. And it is one of those things that the more you put yourself in that situation, you know, in direct terms, like, you do sort of find yourself kind of wanting to look away because it's just hard to take. And so I think that, you know, broaching it through the prism of a story like that, especially when you don't see it coming and you don't know what that's about to happen, it really does have a really visceral impact.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, it was great. Everyone should watch it, especially the people who won't watch it should watch it. And that's more or less what I've got.
Do you think that all those people came out to wherever it is that they came out to in the middle of nowhere? I guess it was near his hometown.
Yeah, it's in Ohio.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It was in yeah.
Well, I
and
had
got
seen
their blankets and stuff, and they got 27 minutes and then left. Like, is that how it worked in real life?
A great question. I'm not sure, but I do. It seemed like there was like a whole evening of stuff happening in some way, music or something. But I do know I had seen he was announcing a series of intimate, socially distant specials in his hometown, like a week before this came out or something.
Hmm.
So this was a thing he was doing. And I don't know if the plan was always to release it or if he just did it and then someone was like, you should release that or what, but I'm glad he did.
I'm glad he did too. And, obviously anytime we get content from that man, it's a blessing.
Please, more Chappelle. Quickly, how do you feel about all the trans stuff right now? 'Cause a big, you know, look, a big, maybe not big, but certainly a noticeable response to this was, you know, how can you demand empathy for your people when you're not empathetic towards trans people. And also, you know, why'd you only mention men and the only women that came up were bitches in the special? And like, for me, that stuff's tough because I do think, especially as a guy with a voice who historically has spoken for an underrepresented population, it'd be great. And it probably Dave Chappelle ought to be more aware of that stuff. And I think the criticism, like, you know, you have made a career of talking about representation of and treatment of black people, but won't afford the trans community the same respect. I get it. But I also, like, I watch this and I see a guy struggling in front of us with a disturbing reality that we're all living in. And I don't know. I don't think to fault him for those things. And maybe that's my own fault.
No, I mean, look, I agree with you. And I would say to that, you know, to those people, it's like, you're not wrong necessarily, but the point of everything isn't everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
no, I think you're right.
This is a 27 minute conversation about race. Like, yep. It doesn't have to be all things to all people.
Yeah. And you know? I by the same token, I'm not going to ignore it or discredit it because last time I got a special from Dave Chappelle, he made some marginally insensitive jokes about trans people.
Yeah. And look, it's fine to be critical of him as, you know, to say he's a hypocrite or whatever. Like, that's a worthy conversation.
Yeah.
But it seems really like beside the point.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, and it's a worthy conversation, but not to me a conversation debilitating enough for Dave Chappelle that I'm not still interested in everything he has to say.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's
tough.
It's
I
find myself saying we let's not make the perfect the enemy of the good a lot lately.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is one of those situations where that applies. You know?
I tend to agree.
Could this thing be better or more enlightened? Sure. But so can most things.
And
it doesn't
really
mean we need
raw.
To get rid of all things, you know?
Yeah. And it really felt raw to me.
And that's I don't want to get too into the, you know, you're disrespecting comedy, but like it's so hard to get up there and go do that. You know what I mean?
It really is.
So to be like, well, I would like it to be more this. It's like,
that's tough.
Yeah, like maybe you have good reasons for that, but like that's not really what this is, you know?
Yep.
So that's where I'm at on it.
All right, let's do some homework.
We should.
So late. We really let this get away from us.
we did. Damn, you designated her.
that's what did it. You're so right. It's a 15-minute designated hitter detour. Jesus. Should probably cut that out, but I'm not gonna.
All right. Well, we'll get back into the challenge, presumably without D again next week. I'm sad that there's no more Top Chef.
It is sad,
but
it's a sad moment.
There is no more Top Chef. So instead, we're going to talk about Perry Mason's return.
Boy, you could not be less excited about Perry Mason. And I don't know why. It's got an actor you like and it's HBO. Like, give it the benefit of the doubt, for God's sake.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard not great things. It's a period piece. So and also, like, I don't really have a lot of love for the original Perry Mason. So really it's Matthew Reese. That's Matthew Reese, and it's airing on HBO. Like, that's what I got.
Well, those are the two things I said. And second of all, do you have any relationship with the original Perry Mason?
I had seen Perry Mason. Yes, I was very young. Okay. Back when you could still find Perry Mason on TV.
You're not that much older than me. Jesus, like
yeah.
I thought Perry Mason was a private eye or something. For God's sakes, turns out he's a defense attorney.
Yeah, he's a lawyer.
Yeah, so I don't know from Perry Mason, but HBO doing a thing with Matthew Reese sounds like something I can get into.
Yeah, I'll check it out. So, but I'm not like over the moon about it. Now, I am excited for the return of the Shy.
Yeah. Although don't know exactly how that's going to look, right?
I mean, I don't know. I've seen a lot of trailers. I think I have a pretty good idea how that's going to look.
No, but I mean, isn't Jason Mitchell gone?
Yes, but I think he was already gone.
Really?
They fired him, and then he got into more trouble with the law. So.
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, but they fired him.
Between this season and the last. So, yeah. Like, it wasn't like he was written out of the show.
Right.
So I'm assuming that they will be writing him out of this next episode. I kind of don't remember. It's been long enough.
I don't remember the end of the last season.
Did he get arrested?
Maybe. I might need to refresh it. But, like, look. Yeah, it was the food truck thing. But, look, listen, he's one of, the three most major characters? It's going to be weird. We spent time on this episode talking about D being weirdly omitted from the challenge. It's going to be weird that one of the central characters just up and vanishes somehow.
Well, but if they didn't resolve the situation with his legal trouble, right? Can they just send him to jail and then that's pretty much going to be it?
Yeah, I guess. But I think if he hadn't actually had real life trouble, he probably would have been on the show in jail.
Right. Probably true.
Sure. They could be like, he went to jail, so he's not really here anymore. But that would be a certainly the most simple way to iron out that problem. But guessing it's going to be more complicated.
A lot of characters in the show. They got a lot of people to focus on. And then I think the big news is that Lena Waithe joining the actual cast this year.
Yeah, exciting. Evanston High School's very own.
I don't think I realized she was Evanston High School's very own.
Yeah, man. Just another one of the great creatives that came out of my alma mater.
I don't know if I have any creatives out of my alma mater. I'm going to look that up for next week. So The Shy's back, and then Search Party Season 3 returning as well. No longer on TBS. It's now an HBO Max property.
Yeah. So that'll be fun. HBO Max, it's really coming through for me.
Yeah. I haven't – again, I think because haven't been a lot of original programming yet, I haven't found myself – spending a crap ton of time on it. It's become my HBO Go, and as I understand it, they're sunsetting HBO Go, so it's going to be everybody's HBO Go.
Wait, so what do you use?
What do I use?
Yeah,
I use HBO Max now to watch basically to watch HBO shows not recorded on my DVR.
I'm saying. Oh, because you just watch on – you have DirecTV or something.
Right. I just have regular linear HBO. So typically record the HBO thing I want to see. But if for whatever reason, then I'll go to HBO Max to watch that HBO program.
I see. See, I was an HBO Now subscriber.
And that is still going to exist from what I understand.
Well, but only because I don't know that that's going to be the case for long. As I understand it, it only exists because HBO Max has not come to an agreement with a couple of – like Roku, you can't have HBO Max on a Roku right now. So, like in my life, my iPhone app and my iPad app and the PlayStation app all automatically turned from Now to Max. And then my Roku on the other TV, it's just stuck on HBO Now, and I can't watch any of the new shows that are on Max only. It's kind of annoying. Ooh,
Roku really has to
figure that out.
And Warner Brothers has to figure that stuff out too, I feel like.
Yeah, but I will say the interface, the selection of movies, the one show we have watched.
They just need more shows.
The rest of it's great. HBO Max. You know, once again, HBO just seems to be like classier than the competition.
Yeah, they know TV, even though they're not TV.
It's not TV. It's HBO. And this is not a podcast anymore. It's time to go. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.